welcome to the Student Life Podcast. I'm your host, Kiri Begnum, and with me, as always, is my friend, colleague, and co-podcaster, Mr. Anthony Giannoumis. Anthony, hello.
Hi, Kira, and happy 2017.
Oh, yeah, same to you.
Unbelievable. We've made it through, this will be our third season.
You're right. That's
something
amazing.
To celebrate right there.
That's amazing. I have a question for you.
Sure.
Imagine you are a carpenter's apprentice.
Okay.
So you've just started carpentry.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been given the task to create a chair.
All right.
But it turns out that no one has told you how to make a chair.
Okay, so I'm kind of improvising a chair.
You may have seen a chair once or twice.
Okay.
But you weren't really aware what it took to create the chair that you saw. In fact, you didn't really pay attention to the chairs that you've seen throughout your life.
I would say that I would try to lower expectations immediately.
And what if you have only like one go of that chair? And what if you have like only a few years and you depend a lot on your personality, on the success of chair?
I would pity the fool who had to sit in that chair.
Turns out that if you are a master student, a PhD student maybe, or a bachelor student, you are at some point asked to write a problem statement.
Sure, sure.
And that is that chair.
Yeah, okay.
So I find it interesting that we in our profession, which is so much about teaching, ask people to write something that we haven't taught them how to write.
It's something about our profession that it aims to be so objective and to be structured, and if you just everything's formulaic, but then at the same time we just expect students to infer how to write a problem statement.
Yeah, and this is one of those things where we just assume that everyone just knows how to do that.
Well, we do, so why wouldn't anyone?
Well, I would say for a long time, I've kind of pretended I did.
Fake it until you make it.
That's a little bit of a shot in the dark, isn't it? Also,
absolutely.
as a method of teaching, like, I'm just going to ask you to spend 2 weeks on something, and then we're going to figure out whether or not you made it or not.
Yeah.
And then if you didn't, well, you kind of wasted 2 weeks.
It's silly. The expectation that a student is somehow going to know how to somehow magically come to this epiphany of, oh, that's how you write a problem statement. Yeah, it'll happen, but it may take them years.
Also, I find it's completely misleading because we call it a problem statement, but it's actually so much more surrounding that one statement.
It really is. If all you can do is write a question, then you're really not doing the job of an introduction.
Right. And the student might see their supervisor or a professor or someone just come up with a problem statement, like out of thin air.
Sure.
But they just have experience and they just do that because they already had some things, you know, brewing in the back of their head.
Chances are.
Yeah. So the thing is, once you do this the first time, actually it's quite hard, and you're actually beginning at the wrong end if you're starting at the problem statement.
Exactly.
And another thing that the student will notice is we are pretty caught up in that problem statement. Like, we talk a lot about that one sentence.
Sure. Well, it is important, but like you said, there's a lot that leads up to it, and there's certainly some things that should be coming after that.
Well, there is a historical perspective to this. I mean, we read a lot of scientific texts, and in order to understand them, they have to kind of follow the same structure.
Yeah.
Or else it's just impossible to get anything out of that. So we require this one sentence, this problem statement, because we need whoever is the author or the researcher to just nail it down to just one sentence.
Right.
So that I know where to look.
Well, without it, it becomes this kind of narrative, and there's not really anything, there's not a clear kind of, okay, this is what I want to know.
Correct. And if you don't have a proper problem statement throughout the document, your idea of what needs to happen or what you want to do may change.
Certainly. If you're not kind of holding yourself accountable to that problem statement and to really constructing or to empirically supporting an answer to that problem statement.
So the problem statement, the reason we have it is it's going to be like a contract in the beginning of the document, yes, to this is what's going to happen and this and why. And we like it because if you see a good problem statement, it says something about the, let's say, skill level of the researcher.
Sure, sure. Because if it's very clear why you're doing the research and it's very clear what research you intend to do,
yeah,
then it shows logical consistency, it shows clarity of thought, and that means that the research that you're doing is more likely to be empirically driven, it's more likely to be substantive.
And it's a whole thing. It's not just a sentence. And the other thing is, there's no magic to this. This is a skill that can be learned.
Sure, sure. You can learn the structure. You can learn the writing style. And you can really learn how to put these together in fairly short order. Because it's not just master's theses and bachelor's theses that are written in this way. Research projects are written this way.
Correct.
White paper reports for government are written this way.
Yes.
Obviously, academic articles. So this format can be really useful in a number of different areas.
The good news is, in this episode, we're going to teach you the format.
Oh, yes.
And it's something I'm convinced that this is something that you'll need over and over and over again. Not necessarily because you're going to write a lot of theses or you're going to do research, but once you got this process down, and it will feel a little bit awkward the first time you do it, but once you got it down, it's really something that helps you, and it will also make you see through other people's stuff.
Yes, yes.
Everything from Kickstarter videos,
mm-hmm,
to fake news on Facebook to research proposals for EU grants.
Yes.
It's all the same structure.
It is.
And I know I've been harping on about how being a student is the same as going to the gym, and you would never do that without having technique. This is one of the techniques.
Yes, this is an exercise.
Yes. Yeah. So this is, and therefore, I would like to apologize to the audio already to begin with, because, well, obviously, it takes a little bit of time to explain this.
Sure. This is going to be a multi-part episode.
I think it will. And you know, there is a lot of thought going through this, and the method that we're going to use is a method that I've been using on a lot of students over the years.
Yeah.
And it has proven to be successful, so I think that everyone should know it, and then you can use it if you want to.
I agree. And it's, I mean, realistically speaking, this problem statement is rooted in a scientific method. So really all you're doing is taking the scientific method and incorporating a narrative in and around it.
Yeah. And I call this approach that I'm using the problem-based approach.
Okay.
I don't know why I do that, but it's actually not the whole truth. But it kind of works as a backdrop to what you want to do. And also, we should remind the audience that this is not only a engineering or computer science thing. This approach will work in any setting you apply it in.
Absolutely. This is just a core kind of research methods approach to writing of the introduction to a thesis, for example.
Correct. No one writes the introduction chapter from the top down to the bottom.
No, certainly.
There's just no way. The particular and the problem statement and everything that we talk about is typically what you would find in the first chapter of a thesis, mm-hmm, or a proposal of any kind or a bachelor project. And there is actually a lot of thought that goes into what to write there.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But if you are disillusioned, you think as a student, so I just sit down at 9 o'clock after I had a coffee and I reward myself and I do not procrastinate anymore. I'm now going to sit down. I'm going to start at the first sentence and I'm going to write.
Blank page.
I'm just going to write the whole first chapter.
Yeah, suddenly it magically manifests itself.
Yes. And look, if you can pull off a first chapter like that, and if everybody likes that, good for you. But the vast majority,
yeah,
they just don't nail it.
Certainly not. And it's not a reflection of bad research or bad ability or bad writing or anything like that. It's just the structure of an introduction is unlike anything else you'll have to write.
Yeah. If you are aware of the structure, it at the same time helps you properly define what you're actually going to do.
Exactly.
So at the end of it, you actually feel, oh my God, I have a plan.
Yes. I have a map.
There is a light at the end of the tunnel. And I mean, I feel sorry for all, especially master students who spend too much time figuring out what they want to do.
Yeah.
So this is a help to, all right, let's figure out, let's make a plan. And if it looks like something you don't want to do, well, congratulations. Now you know.
Yes, exactly.
Let's fix that.
Well, and there's no shortcuts here, right?
No.
You can't, I mean, it's very few of us can who know exactly what they want to do and then just do it. Most of us take many paths and try things, and things don't work. And I'm hoping that this podcast enables you to skip some of that experimentation on your way
right.
to becoming a great writer and a great thesis writer.
So we're going to start off with a process, assuming that you kind of have a thesis topic.
Yes.
You already have like a vague idea of what you want to do.
Right.
What you don't have at the moment is a good way to explain to everyone how and why
yeah.
and so on. So mm-hmm. this is like after you've agreed on a topic, maybe your supervisor has given you something, maybe your task is quite directly defined, but just because you know doesn't mm-hmm. mean that the audience will know when they read your text.
Of course not.
So the whole thing is about convincing everyone else of what is going to happen and why.
And you really have to be skeptical when you approach this. You can't approach it from the standpoint of, oh, only my supervisor will read this.
Yeah.
You really have to approach it thinking, I need to imagine the person with the least amount of experience reading
That's
this.
That's true.
And walk them through that. I mean, obviously, you know, conventional terms, you don't have to define everything that you come across. But it should certainly be understandable to someone who is familiar with the research in your field.
Well, we call it someone who has a little bit of domain knowledge.
Exactly, exactly.
Someone who is slightly informed.
Yeah.
But I actually, in the onset of this method, I would assume, think about someone that you meet on a kind of family gathering.
Sure, sure.
Like an uncle or an aunt. Someone who, out of politeness, asks you, so what do you write about? And then, you know, what would you answer?
Yeah.
And maybe they are polite enough to stay interested and dig a little bit deeper. So mm-hmm. this is what we're going to help out with. So my method has three parts.
Okay.
And we're going to start with the first part, and that is called the scaffolding.
Okay.
And this is where we build the scaffolding that will later be a help for writing the first chapter.
Okay.
So in part one, step one is define the problem domain.
Yes.
And for those of you who are listening who don't know what problem domain means, it means the overall era.
Yeah, the field within which your
yes.
research fits.
Like, and this is sometimes you pick the problem domain where your uncle would agree with you that there is a problem.
Right.
So you could be broad.
Yes, you should be broad.
Correct. So this, like if you do computer science, it should mm-hmm. probably be a little bit higher than computer science.
Yes.
If you do health mm-hmm. care, then maybe some factor in society, like
sure.
health in general, longevity.
Yeah,
if
yeah,
you do
yeah.
economics, it may be bigger democratic problems such as the distribution of wealth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, you need to take care that you are not too broad or bombastic. So try to stay away from sentences like since the beginning of time.
Right.
Or words like humankind.
And it's important also in this, especially in these first couple of sentences, that whatever statements you do make, you're not just making them as this kind of unsubstantiated kind of, oh, we know this to be true.
Correct.
Because your reader may not know this to be true, and it may be actually controversial, and you don't realize that.
Correct.
So whatever statement you make right off the bat, it needs to be substantiated.
And it needs to be somewhere where you think that the broad majority would agree with you.
Sure.
So you start with a common accepted challenge.
Common ground.
Yes. And the next step is what I call the problematization.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a series of statements.
Mm-hmm.
Now, don't start thinking about writing this as a text. It's just a series of statements at first. Yeah. And what you do is you always point out a problem in each statement. But it's a funnel in that it digs deeper and deeper and deeper.
Right.
So you make a statement about a problem, and then subconsciously, or maybe you just, you know, think about that problem. You break it down into sub problems,
mm-hmm.
and you pick one of them.
Yeah.
One of the sub problems.
Right.
And then you write a statement about that sub problem. I'm going to give you an example.
Okay, later. I'm just chomping at the bit for an example now.
And then you do that 5 or 6 times until you have arrived at your particular task.
Your niche.
Yes. And after that, you will start, is the next step is when you will start to dream about the potential impact if that one small tiny pebble of a sub-problem that you have found, if that would be fixed.
Okay.
And that would obviously have an impact that would lead all the way back to the main challenge.
Right. It's kind of connecting the dots.
Yes. It's a baby step.
I think of it as the first couple of sentences being kind of the nucleus. And then as you take further steps outward, you're eventually kind of probing the extent of the knowledge that we have.
Correct. So, but here you start with a problem domain, which is broad, and you go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper.
So maybe inverted from what I said. Yes.
But when you start talking about impact,
mm-hmm.
again, you have the big picture.
You're ratcheting back out again.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is correct. So the reason you want to do that is it's hard for anyone else to follow your logic.
Well, typically these topics are incredibly complex.
Yes. So you want to lead the audience along the path from the big problem they know about
mm-hmm.
to the small piece that you are going to work on.
Yeah. And that typically they won't know about.
Correct. So we need to figure out a way down there. But mm-hmm. that step is just write down those statements. Identify those sub-problems and sub-problems and sub-problems
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and problems of problems of problems.
Yeah.
Now, this process is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the part of the problem that my students find most challenging.
Sure.
Because it requires domain knowledge. Mm-hmm. It means you need to be able to create a logical bridge from the problem domain quite down to your little piece.
Yeah.
And it's not enough to say it's important.
No.
You actually have to figure out where it belongs in the big picture.
I live by the rule that if you have to say it's important, then you didn't say it correctly.
Yeah. If you find this to be hard, then work with your supervisor.
Sure.
Anyone else who you think has domain knowledge mm-hmm. or experience in the field, and they will help you find that path.
Yeah.
And this is why the professors are often just coming off these from the cuff, just out of the cuff, but
mm-hmm.
they have that domain knowledge.
Yes.
And they just, that's just obvious to them.
Sure.
But it's not obvious to the reader, and it's oftentimes not obvious to you.
Yeah, as a student, sure. Yeah. And I think having that domain knowledge is really critical because we're talking about synthesizing a vast amount of literature.
Yeah.
Certainly in the first couple of statements, you're talking about maybe even hundreds of years worth of research.
Yes.
As you grow more and more narrow and start to occupy your niche, you're probably getting into more recent research and you're probably getting into a much smaller domain of research. But even still, that can be really challenging for a new student or
right.
new researcher.
Right. So this means also that every statement you make should be something that you can back up.
Oh, certainly.
So try to stay away from ambiguous terms such as better or bad, something that cannot really be proven.
We call it normative terms.
Yes. And make sure that there is some research that you can use or other material or data that you can use to back up. But you will not back it up in the introduction. My advice is always you save that for the background chapter.
Okay.
But this gives you a lot of ammunition, and all of a sudden you know what you're supposed to write about in the background chapter.
Yes.
Because every statement you make should be backed up in the background chapter.
Sure, sure. I usually recommend to my students that in the introduction, they're sparing with their citations.
Yes.
That they certainly use citations, especially if they're going to make a broad claim or a claim that may be controversial.
Yes.
But then the background chapter, as you say,
yes,
contains the bulk of this is the literature that really matters.
Correct.
To me.
Because in the introduction chapter, in my view, is going to convince you. It's not going to lecture you.
No,
if
yes,
you want to be lectured, like if you don't believe the statements,
mm-hmm,
then please have a look at the background chapter.
Yes, yes.
And then you will be motivated enough to do so. But other than that, we're just going to fire arguments at you.
Yeah,
it's just going to convince you.
Yeah, statement after statement that logically connect,
yes,
with one another. And I think making those connections can be really challenging sometimes for students because you're not only structuring them sentence to sentence, but you're also structuring them paragraph to paragraph.
Yes.
And that requires a higher, and really the entire section should be cohesive.
Yes.
So that requires a level of analytical thinking that I think most students are not necessarily used to.
No, but it is a skill.
Yes, it's
and,
very much
and
a skill.
If you follow this process, this will come as a natural byproduct.
Right, yes.
So we talked about step three, which is dreaming about the impact,
mm-hmm,
if you would be able to fix the problem. Now comes step four, which is actually write the problem statements.
Okay.
We're still not done with everything.
No.
It's still only part one out of three. So,
okay,
you know, don't get too amped up.
No.
So essentially, the problem statement, and this has many names, thesis, statement,
hypothesis,
research question,
yeah,
whatever. It maybe they're formulated a little bit differently in your particular field, but it's always the same thing. Essentially, you want to investigate something. You are proposing some kind of activity by which you will somehow address the problem.
Yes, that again,
you pointed out,
naturally and logically extends from the previous discussion that
you
had.
From the lowest pebble that you had.
Exactly.
Your end station, that's where you're going to work.
Right.
However, keep in mind, you are not going to fix the problem.
No,
and this
not in the introduction.
This separates us, not even in the problem statement, this separates us from engineering.
Okay.
Because in engineering, let's say that there's a river you must cross.
Mm-hmm.
In engineering, the problem is, I'm just going to get you over the water.
Okay.
That would solve it.
That's how it works.
Yes. The research question is, are bridges a suitable method of crossing rivers?
Okay.
You are not fixing the coming across the water.
No.
But you are investigating very much a potential method.
Yeah, the how.
And whether or not it will work.
Interesting.
This means that whatever your means of crossing the river is, if it hasn't been tried before in the particular method you are considering, it is as interesting if everyone drowns as if everyone is able to cross the river. That's the difference.
Sure.
In engineering, you are a very bad engineer if they
drown.
As a scientist, you sit there, I'm going to write this up as a research paper.
Yeah.
Because the rest of the world needs to know that this is not a way to cross the river.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
So, and this is, you have to be very aware of this because a lot of students come from, let's say, an engineering-dominated field.
Yeah, sure.
Where they think my task is to fix it.
Yeah, well, not even only in engineering. I find this in almost any topic.
Yes.
They don't think in terms of trying to disprove their assumptions. They think they want to try to confirm their assumptions.
Yes, and which leads to a very known phenomenon, which is cherry picking.
Yeah,
and that means if you have a problem statement that kind of promises you're going to be able to cross the river, you're going to look for the data. So if one person made it through, you're going to say, well, there is a percentage chance of your method, even though, but I don't think it's the best method. So you have to keep that in mind that you are a spectator that's going to investigate.
Right.
You're the referee. You're not a player.
And this is where these kind of normative statements of bad, good, better, worse kind of come into play.
Correct.
Because typically if you fall down that ladder of like, oh, I'm going to, you know, is this method better or is this the best method, then you're really not problematizing it well.
Correct. And we're going to talk about the particular words you choose in there.
Yeah.
But what you're going to do at this point is you're going to write down the activity that will probably lead to the outcome that would hopefully impact the problem.
Sure, sure. You're going to talk about the methods. Yes.
And, but here we need to keep in mind that a problem can be many things.
Right.
So, for instance, like the end problem you ended up with could be there is something we don't know enough about.
Right.
It could be there is a tool that is missing.
Yeah.
Which is sounds very engineering.
Mm-hmm.
It could be we don't know how to do it properly. So there's a methodology that is missing.
There could be there's a theory that we haven't tested in this way.
Correct. There could also mean that we have data, but we don't have the insight about the data.
Yes.
Or we lack the insight and also the data, at which point the problem is we don't have the data.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there are a lot of ways that to look at what a problem is.
Mm-hmm.
It's not everything doesn't work or it's bad or it doesn't perform well. But sometimes, let's say in economics,
mm-hmm,
it's like, yeah, we have this question, but a sub-problem to that to answering that question is, where's the data that we could look at?
Exactly, yeah.
But it could be also, well, we have the data, but no one has looked at the data.
And it could be we have the data, but is the data what we expect it to be or what we assume it is?
Correct, or the data is for too short of a period. We need to advance. Yeah. So there's always, if you look at it, there's always some kind of criticism.
Yes,
which is why you are doing what you're doing.
It's not worth doing if it was. No, there wasn't a gap in the research. No one
would pay you to do it if it was established knowledge.
Yes, this is
so
very true.
So this is step four, where you would then write the problem statement. But remember, you're not fixing the problem. You are investigating a means of addressing the problem.
Yes.
So I know that this sounds very weird when I say it, but as soon as you tried this a couple of times, all of a sudden you will see what I mean. So are you ready for an example?
Well, I want to say something else about the problem statements. These can vary in scope, even though we're describing them as like the pebble in the shoe. They're always going to be the pebble in the shoe in the context of the introduction.
Yes.
But they're not necessarily all pebbles that take 3 months to fix or find an answer to. They're not necessarily, some of them could be 10-year pebbles.
Yeah.
Some of them could be 3-month pebbles, as we discussed. So you really have to work on that problem statement, scoping it in a way that's appropriate for the time that you have in your thesis. And I find most master students tend to scope very large, and I will try to coach them and say that actually that project has taken other people 11 years to work on, and you're not going to finish it in the 9 months that you have for your thesis.
And this is why you need someone with research experience.
Yes.
To understand the practicalities. But I will point out how you will help yourself detect those probable mistakes, like promising too much. So
let's do it.
Let's have one example. So this is a real life, or it's partially real life inspired.
Ooh.
This was at a conference where I was still a PhD student, but this was the first time that someone was able to capture me or capture my interest as an audience member in their presentation and keep my attention and also fully convince me of the necessity of the research that other PhD student was doing.
That's awesome.
Like, I was sold.
You were ready to do it for them.
I don't remember. This was some years ago, but I have written I've now done my own method and completed the problem domain, the particular steps, and I've also written the problem statement.
Awesome.
And then we're going to use this for the next part, which is quality assurance.
Ooh, I like it.
All right, are you ready?
I'm ready. Hit me. What do we got?
The problem domain is HIV/AIDS.
Okay, the epidemic of HIV/AIDS?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
And this is something that everyone knows about.
Yes, I think we're all aware.
And everyone is fully in agreement that it's really sad.
Yes, it's
No one will say, is there really something worthwhile doing within the scope of HIV/AIDS?
There has been for decades, and I'm sure there will continue to be many topics within the epidemiology of HIV/AIDS that is worth exploring.
So I would maybe, so that's it. That's the problem domain.
Okay.
Step one.
Awesome.
Here's step two. This is a problematization. Here come my statements.
Right.
So I will do this a little bit slow at first, right? Every year, 1.1 million people die due to AIDS-related illnesses.
And the reason why that's really effective is it because it makes it, it automatically justifies the reason for researching
and
this topic.
And that was the sentence he said. Well, he didn't say 1.1 million because those are recent numbers. I just looked them up before the episode.
Sure,
but they are still incredibly depressing.
It's automatically something that everyone can agree on is unacceptable.
Yeah,
it's like, a preventable disease.
Yeah, 1.1 million every year.
Yeah.
Like, when that just sinks in,
mm-hmm.
It depresses you.
Well, it really yes, does. It does. And hopefully inspires you as well, to
sure.
at least to continue down this road.
So what I do, next statement, here comes statement number two.
Okay.
AIDS-HIV has an enormous detrimental effect on people's lives as well as grave socioeconomic effects.
Okay.
I'm boiling it down.
Yes.
Yes.
But you're boiling it down in a really important way because you're not just saying that HIV AIDS is bad because it kills a lot of people. You're saying that it's bad. And then here are several other dimensions and reasons why it's causing a
problem.
I broke
the problem apart.
Yes.
I broke it apart and I picked a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm going to break that piece apart as well.
Okay.
Statement number three.
I love it.
Treatment methods for people with HIV AIDS are still being discovered and investigated, but no cure has been found so far.
Okay. I like it.
And we go deeper. One of the challenges for medical research is the ability to properly test their newly discovered medications due to the practical difficulties of conducting human trials.
Okay, so look at how they walked us through that. They went from AIDS is really bad, it kills a lot of people, but AIDS is also bad because of these other dimensions.
Yes.
And now, well, really one of the challenges that we are facing as a society is understanding how to test and how to really deal with finding and using the new cure or the new treatments that come out.
So these kind of statements, I call them a give and take.
Okay.
I'm pointing towards, well, someone is working on it,
mm-hmm.
but they have a problem.
Right.
So I'm giving hope.
Yes.
But I'm taking hope away.
Yes.
And so I was at number four. I'm now talking about medical researchers.
Right.
In fact. So, because they are a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
They're part of that story. Number five, computer simulations can provide an additional source of insight into how medication works. So, again, I gave hope. But currently, we lack the ability to properly represent how the HIV virus spreads in the human body.
And if you read that statement first, nobody
no.
would be, would
you, don't
be,
see
you would lose 90% of the audience.
Yes.
Why
and
are
this
we
is,
talking about
and
this?
And this is typically where you find someone who is completely caught up in their field and
yeah.
you know, they're working frantically on a problem. You ask them why, but you know, we don't know how this works in computer simulations. Why is it important? And what they forgot to tell you, 1.1 million people
yes.
die every year.
Yes, yes.
That's
yes,
why
yes.
this is important. Now I go even further.
Okay.
This is the last statement. So now I'm at my pebble in my shoe.
Okay.
All right. The work of Spitzfein and Marcus has proposed a working computer simulation design that closely represents how viruses spread in the human body and has now been adapted for HIV.
Mm-hmm.
But the application developed, Spectrum, is run as a single thread, which means simulation times normally take days, therefore become impractical.
Oh my gosh, I love how this story has been playing out because it started with this overarching concern about society and the epidemic of HIV AIDS, and it's gotten down to this level of, but actually the software that we have just sucks.
Yes, and you could not tell until the lower statements that I was actually doing computer science.
Right. And you can't jump from the one to the other. And that's the other thing I see students do a lot is they'll start with a nice domain statement and then they go from that directly into the pebble. And then it's kind of like, well, wait a minute, what happened between all
it's
that?
It's something they assume, but they haven't made that assumption explicit.
And usually they know the connections.
Yes.
But they, again, you as you said, they haven't made it explicit.
Right. So This process helps them, all right, let's actually point it out.
Mm-hmm,
let's
mm-hmm.
create that path
yeah.
from the top down to the bottom. And then here, then I complete the next step, which is now I dream
okay.
about impact.
Yeah.
If we were able to port Spectrum, developed by Spitzstein and Marcus,
mm-hmm.
as a distributed workload suitable for cloud environments,
mm-hmm.
we could leverage the global available cloud resources in order to dramatically reduce simulation times. Shorter simulations would allow medical research to progress faster in their search for HIV/AIDS.
That's amazing. Now, there was a lot of jargon in that, so I'll yes. be a little bit critical and say that they could have maybe rephrased things a little bit simpler or defined things. But if you got domain knowledge in this area, yes. then I'm sure it's crystal clear for you.
Now, I wrote this a little bit like I would write a research paper.
Okay,
now,
fair
now,
enough.
Now, when you know this process,
yeah.
it's easy to look at all research papers and you will find this particular structure.
Absolutely.
And what's funny is a lot of people write that structure, but they've never been taught how to do it. So it's just by happenstance. And probably that's why they survived academia to begin with.
Yes, this is the truth. Now, I can think of a couple of fields where this may not hold true, and that is anthropology and possibly law. So if you have, if you're in a field like that, or if you just, you're not quite sure about what we're saying here, check with someone who is an expert in the field and make sure that this applies there.
I think it still can. But yeah, I agree
so?
With
okay.
you. You will probably find your supervisor to maybe have a different method, in which case, great, now you know two
sure.
methods.
There you go.
Yeah.
But so, ours certainly applies in all science-related disciplines.
I think they do. And also, you can use the same method to convince your boss of why you should get funding to work on a particular interesting project.
Absolutely, or convince your government for doing
yes.
the same thing.
And here comes the problem statement. So this is then the last step in
okay.
part one. Problem statement, design and develop a multi-thread version of Spectrum in order to achieve reduced simulation times.
Okay.
That's it.
Sure.
That's the one small thing I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm a computer scientist. I'm just going to make that damn Spectrum work with multiple cores, not just one,
yeah.
which is backward.
Right.
But why? Because 1.1 million people die.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
why. So I'm part of it.
Yes.
I'm part of the fight.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's important because your uncle or auntie who is listening to you,
mm-hmm,
will they will ask you, what do you do? Well, I'm kind of trying to make Spectrum multi-thread.
Nobody's going to understand that.
No. So what are you going to do? I'm helping the fight on AIDS.
Yes, I'm helping
Boom.
To try to diminish the number of people that die
yes.
every year from AIDS.
That's when you do the mic drop and you go over to the buffet and get more cake.
I love it. Now, the statement that you use is really appropriate for computer science, because I think a lot of the development work for
yeah.
thesis happens in exactly that way. For other fields that look at a problem statement more as a research question,
mm-hmm.
the expectation would be that that statement is in the phrase of a question, is phrased as a question. How do we know that
yes.
this exists, or how do we know that A relates to B and only
All right.
B?
And this boils down to what the particular field defines as being a problem.
Right.
Is it lack of insights?
Yeah,
right?
Sure,
is
sure.
Is it lack of methodology?
Yeah, yeah.
And oftentimes in the human sciences, it's often a lack of model. Like, how does this
sure.
work abstractly?
Yeah, right.
In economics, it's often there's abundance of data, but there's no insight.
Yes.
Like, we have tax records for hundreds of years, but we don't know how the distribution of wealth works.
Or the insights are competing, and
yes.
then you have to kind of draw a line and say, hey, well, this may have worked in this time or with this
yes.
data set, but it doesn't work with this data
Correct.
Set.
Sometimes it's, but very often, if you're able to pick out what the particular problem is, like if it is lack of knowledge, lack of insight, lack of method, lack of data.
Yeah.
If it's one of those, you're in good shape.
Yeah, absolutely. You've already done your homework and you're
yeah.
already well on your way to constructing
you know
a
your place.
Yes.
You know your place in the world of research. And that's a good thing.
It is. And it's really difficult for especially students, I find, because they tend to kind of overindulge. And
yeah.
they read all this magnificent literature, and then they go, I don't know where my stuff fits in this. And they really need a guidance on how to, and maybe it's just actually doing, writing out those problem statements so that way you can see where your research fits in the larger scope of things.
So I'm going to quickly repeat the steps of part one.
Awesome.
And then we will use that to conclude the first part. And then the next part, we're going to look at part two
Ooh.
And three. Which are called quality assurance,
yeah.
because just because you wrote statements doesn't mean that they work.
Yes, this is true.
And also then how you, part three is how we tie all of this together to create that first chapter.
Brilliant.
All right, so let me just quickly for the reader remind you of the steps. So part one was the scaffolding. Step one, define the problem's domain,
mm-hmm.
find out where you can start. Step two, write the problematization as those several statements.
Mm-hmm.
and you break down every problem into a smaller problem and smaller problem and smaller problem until you arrived at what you so aptly put as the pebble in the shoe.
Yes.
Which is where you're going to work. Step three, dream about the potential impact.
Mm-hmm.
Think big picture again. Think about how solving that small, how taking that small pebble out of your shoe would enable, you know, would save the world more or less. At least address the problem domain from the beginning.
Sure.
Step four, write the actual problem statement.
Yes. Don't skip that part. That's really important.
I guess this ends part one. Okay. And we're going to reconvene for the next episode where we're going to talk about quality assurance and breaking the whole thing down again.
Awesome. Do you have a pro tip so far?
Pro tip so far, I guess work with another student.
Okay.
On specifying the statements.
Okay. And my pro tip is more of a writing style thing. I think students often, especially in the introduction, fall in this crevasse of making very long, convoluted sentences. And you don't
like
need
I
that.
Just did.
Well, we all do. But you certainly shouldn't be doing that in your introduction. What you want is very short statements that are substantiated by previous research or data or whatever it is that connect with one another. So if you find yourself writing 40, 50 word sentences, break that into four sentences.
Right. I'm so used to this process. Mm-hmm. So I'm already writing prose when I write those statements.
Yeah.
But my students, when they work at this, they actually have broad statements. And you have to remember, these statements may not even make it into the actual text. So they have stuff like, but it's too slow. But they kind of follow the logic and they use this as a scaffolding. Just to get the ducks in a row,
mm-hmm,
and to understand exactly what order of things that they're working with.
Well, part of problematizing things is operationalizing things.
Yes.
It's taking abstract ideas and kind of concretizing them into something that is a little bit more understandable.
But we're going to talk about that. But, for the listener, don't get too caught up with your English or your particular phrasing.
Sure.
As long as you're able to identify the problem, break it down, make a new statement about the next size.
Excellent.
All right. So we're going to reconvene for the next part.
Yes. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns for us, please reach out to us. We love getting email. You can contact us at studentlife, all one word, at hioa.no. Again, that's studentlife@hioa.no.
Have a great student life.